on the Pacifica Radio app. This is Houston's community station. We are Quantum Leap Radio.
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
There have been a lot of major stories this week, so of course that is not what we're covering, because I let the major media do that. Yep. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is freezing temperatures. And this is an excerpt from communityimpact.com. Harris County and Houston officials outline preparations for freezing temperatures. Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo and Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner said the hard freeze coming to the region the night of December 22nd will not be as severe as Winter Storm Uri in February 2021 during a news conference December 20th. A lot of confusing dates there, but basically, I did not know that these two were meteorologists, but we'll see. Temperatures will dip below 24 degrees Fahrenheit for extended periods for 3 nights and 3 mornings, but precipitation is not in the forecast, according to Hidalgo. This hard freeze is something we face about once every 5 years or so. I don't know, seems more often to me. And it's something we can handle so long as we work together, Hidalgo said. According to Hidalgo, the electric... Reliability Council of Texas has made assurances that residents should not expect widespread power outages and that it is well prepared to handle the hard freeze coming to the region. Turner said CenterPoint Energy would not disconnect residents' power and added the Houston Public Works Department is taking precautions to keep its facilities up and running. According to Turner, the following 5 locations will serve as warming centers. I'm going to read them quickly, but you can go to thinkwingradio.com, and I have them posted along with the original article link. The Fondy Community Center on Sabine, the Moody Community Center on Fulton, Acres Homes Multi-Service Center on West Montgomery, George R. Brown Convention Center, the Houston Recovery Center for the Houston Police Department on North Chenevert. Turner said the locations are not shelters, but will provide blankets, chairs, water, and snacks, and are open to pets. Turner said Lakewood Church will also serve as a warming center. According to Turner, the MTA of Harris County will be operating a normal schedule. There is also a link, readyharris.org. Again, link is in the post, thinkwingradio.com, as well as in the article. And then there is an additional article that has sort of a little different spin from communityimpact.com because it's written out of Austin. Ahead of below freezing temperatures, ERCOT prepares power grid. Ahead of the cold weather, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which manages the state's power grid, issued an operating condition notice on December 16th. The notice informs transmission and distribution owners of the, quote, predicted extreme cold weather event. According to a news release, extremely cold weather occurs when temperatures reach 25 degrees Fahrenheit or colder. Temperatures will dip below 25 degrees in Austin, San Antonio, and Dallas, while the low temperature in Houston will be about 26, AccuWeather reported. I looked this up, and Houston temps, at least according to my iPhone, are expected to drop into the mid-20s to high teens at night during the freeze, with daytime highs in the low 30s to mid-40s through the weekend. Going back to the article, the power grid will have, quote, sufficient generation to meet forecasted demand, the release said. As the demand for energy increases in Texas, officials have assured residents the lights will stay on this winter. ERCOT and its regulator, the Public Utility Commission of Texas, face heavy distrust and criticism from all sides. Yeah, I agree. Largely due to the grid's inability to withstand Winter Storm Uri in February 2021. Over two-thirds of Texans lost power during the storm, and nearly half lost access to running water, according to previous reporting by Community Impact. I will also note, although I don't think it's in the article, that something like 100 or 150 people died due to lack of heat and or water or electric. Okay, I was shopping yesterday, and because I was there because I was basically out of food. But I saw other folks shopping like it was February 2021, except this time everyone obviously swore to be prepared. And it really just goes to show how easily and deeply trauma can slip into a society and change long-term and perhaps even generational behavior. Andrew?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that. I have zero trust in ERCOT personally. And I've heard some people theorizing that most of the grid improvement funds have just gone to line the pockets of those who are friendly to the people in power. I should say that that's not concrete, and I'm not making any accusations, but it wouldn't surprise me if it were true. I'll be making sure all my batteries are charged and that my gas tank is full. One thing that cannot be emphasized enough, if your power or heating go out, do not run your car, generator, or anything that produces exhaust indoors. That exhaust is toxic, and it can and will kill you. That was a lot of the deaths that you mentioned earlier. Back in the winter storm Uri. Run them outside where the wind can take the exhaust away and you'll be fine.
And remember, the garage, if it's attached to the house, is included in that indoors.
Yes.
And also remember that they recommend that you keep anything running an engine that emits carbon monoxide well away from any windows or doors that might leak into the house. If you have a carbon monoxide sensor, detector, thank you, in your house, that would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of thing can kill you.
Absolutely.
It really can. Okay, I do have some references. I have a YouTube reference, Preparing Your Pipes for the Cold Weather, from KHOU. Also from KHOU, I have a couple of articles, as well as how to protect your plants during freezing temperatures. Of course, the answer to that mostly is...
bring them inside.
Warm. Yeah. Okay. Our next story, also from CommunityImpact.com, Mayor Sylvester Turner announces agreement with Houston, Harris County, and TxDOT, as well as, I might add, the federal government, over the I-45 project. In a December 19th announcement, the city of Houston reached an agreement with the Texas Department of Transportation and Harris County over the North Houston Highway Improvement Project and I-45. This comes after the county's lawsuit against the state over the civil rights implications of the highway. I have always said in its current state, I-45 is not safe, Mayor Sylvester Turner said. It doesn't meet our flooding needs or our mobility needs. Turner said this is one of the largest transportation projects Houston will see in a generation. The approved plan will not only be modernized primarily by usage of its current footprint to reduce congestion, but it will also set a precedent for how roads can benefit communities, according to information provided during the news conference. The $9 billion plan entails providing more pedestrian and bike trails along green space, such as White Oak Bayou, Buffalo Bayou, and Emancipation Trail, and the minimizing of the highway's current presence in green spaces, in addition to flood mitigation and the reduction of historic flood patterns. The community came together and said, we can do better, said Harris County Precinct 2 Commissioner Adrian Garcia. The project will connect communities via current streets such as Andrews, Lamar, and McKinney. It will also provide assistance and compensation to residents displaced by the construction and relocating so they can stay within their communities. Construction on the next segment involving the Greater Heights and Fifth Ward will start in 2023. Andrew?
Well, this is definitely better news than the last we heard of it, but I'm not qualified to say if it's good enough. I want to know how community members, civil rights groups, and sustainable urban planning experts feel before the project goes ahead.
I actually basically agree with Andrew on this point. I did dig a little deeper. The article says that leaders are on board, but there really isn't much detail on what they're on board with. There's a lot of general discussion about, yes, it'll be better, and yes, it'll connect communities rather than divide them, and yes, there'll be more green space. But the only graphic I could find was a couple of years old, so I'm sure it's changed since then. So this is strictly to be continued.
And did they mention, give any detail about what organizations those leaders were leading of, were leading, rather?
Well, Texas Department of Transportation, Harris County, and the City of Houston.
And that's it?
Well, there was one group mentioned in the article that's still a nay. But, you know, there's always going to be a nay, even if you have what some people think is the perfect plan, except we don't know whether this plan is perfect, imperfect, somewhat perfect, or really sucky.
Right. Yeah.
So we just don't know yet. We just know that in principle there's an agreement. And, of course, the devil is always in the details.
Yeah. The point I was making was, you know, if it's not leaders of those particular groups I mentioned, that doesn't answer my question. But, of course, you know, it's still useful to know who does like the plan and who wants to see it go forward. So,
well, it obviously doesn't answer my questions either, which is why this is to be continued.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, BBC News. Guns confiscated at U.S. airports hit record levels. A record number of firearms was confiscated from U.S. airports in 2022, transport officials have said. A total of 6,301 guns were taken at checkpoints as of mid-December, and of those, 88% were still loaded, because I guess the only way to stop a bad terrorist with a gun is a good terrorist with a gun. The Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, said it expects to confiscate 6,600 guns by year's end, a 10% increase over 2021's record level. Hartsfield-Jackson Airport in Atlanta, Georgia, had the highest number of recorded firearm stops. Oh, shucks. While Dallas-Fort Worth and the state of Texas had the second highest. But we're number one in guns. Anyway, no reason was given for why people were attempting to clear security while carrying a weapon, not to mention a loaded one. If TSA officials detect a weapon at a checkpoint, they issue a civil penalty that varies by number of previous offenses and whether the gun was loaded at the time. The agency also said it is raising the maximum civil penalty for a firearms violation from $13,910 to $14,950. There were an estimated 390 million guns in circulation in the U.S. in 2018, according to figures from the Small Arms Survey, a Swiss-based leading research project. You know, more guns than people, so I guess we're talking two-handed gun wielders, right? So that way only half the people use the guns, but the people use twice as many guns at one time. Might make sense in an alternate reality. Andrew?
Well, you know, I think the overwhelming majority of these incidents will be people just not knowing or not thinking about both airport rules and common sense. If it was more serious, I think there would be more trumpeting about foiled terror attacks. I encourage all of our listeners who may be traveling soon to know the TSA's requirements about taking guns on planes. We've linked that on the blog post at thinkwingradio.com. The most immediately obvious advice, though, is don't try to take it through airport security and don't bring it to the airport loaded.
And there are government elected officials, U.S. federal elected officials, and possibly state ones as well, that have actually done this.
Yes.
Republicans. But
mostly,
you know,
yeah.
Still, I will also point out that I carry essentially like a Swiss Army knife in my watch pocket in my jeans. Mm-hmm. And I always try to remember to leave that thing home or put it in checked luggage.
Checked luggage, yep.
And, you know, it's probably about a $15 or $20 utility knife. Mm-hmm. And I've probably paid $60 for it at this point.
Yep.
Because when I forget to put it in checked luggage, I have to pay over $20 to mail it back to myself, or else they confiscate it. I happen to like it. It's, you know, hard to find specific things you like. Mm. And this is not a big knife. This is a legal blade, but, you know, not on an airplane.
Right, exactly.
Anyway. And guns, people. I mean, I'm thinking knives, and these people are thinking loaded weapons. Okay. I think this would be a good moment for a break, and then we'll talk about something else that's out of control. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. You can download it with Google Podcasts, available from both the Android and iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this and over 100 other KPFT programs. Every story on this show is heavily excerpted, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click on Show Posts and More at the top of the webpage and find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. You can check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio so far. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, so far, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Okay, as promised from CNN, out of control. No one knows how much to tip. A new checkout trend is sweeping across America, making for an increasingly awkward experience. Digital tip jars. You order a coffee, ice cream, salad, or a slice of pizza and pay with your credit card or phone. Then an employee standing behind the counter spins around a touchscreen and slides it in front of you, and the screen has a few suggested tip amounts, usually 10, 15, or 20%, or leave a custom tip, or no tip at all. Customers and workers today are confronted with a radically different tipping culture compared to just a few years ago, without any clear norms. Although consumers are accustomed to tipping waiters, bartenders, and other service workers, tipping a barista or a cashier may be a new phenomenon for many shoppers. It's being driven in large part by changes in technology that have enabled business owners to more easily shift the costs of compensating workers directly to consumers, which is, I thought, what prices were supposed to do. Said Michael Lynn, a professor of consumer behavior and marketing at Cornell University, "I don't know how much you're supposed to tip, and I study this." Adding to the changing dynamics, customers were encouraged to tip generously during the pandemic to help keep restaurants and stores afloat, raising expectations. The shift to digital payments also accelerated during the pandemic, leading stores to replace old-fashioned cash tip jars with tablet touchscreens. Customers are overwhelmed by the number of places where they now have the option to tip and feel pressure about whether to add a gratuity and for how much. Some customers tip no matter what. Others feel guilty if they don't. One Starbucks barista in Washington State said he understands if a customer doesn't tip for a drip coffee order, but if he makes a customized drink after spending time talking to the customer about exactly how it should be made, it does make me a little bit disappointed if I don't receive a tip, he said. Tipping service workers was essentially built into law by the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act, which created the federal minimum wage that excluded restaurant and hospitality workers. This allowed the tipping system to proliferate in these industries. In 1966, Congress created a sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. The federal minimum wage for tipped employees has stood at $2.13 per hour, lower than the $7.25 federal minimum since 1991, although many states require higher base wages for tipped employees. If a server's tips don't add up to the federal minimum, the law says the employer must make up the difference, but this does not always happen. Wage theft and other wage violations are common in the service industry. Just how much to tip is entirely subjective and varies across industries, and I might mention countries. And the link between the quality of service and the tip amount is surprisingly weak, Lynn from Cornell said. The gig economy has also changed tipping norms. An MIT study released in 2019 found that customers are less likely to tip when workers have autonomy over whether and when to work. This surprised me. Nearly 60% of Uber customers never tip, while only about 1% always tip, a 2019 University of Chicago study found. What makes it confusing, Lynn said, is that there's no central authority that establishes tipping norms. You should almost always tip workers earning the sub-minimum wage, such as restaurant servers and bartenders, say advocates and tipping experts. When given the option to tip in places where workers make an hourly wage, such as Starbucks baristas, customers should use their discretion and remove any guilt from their decision, etiquette experts say. It's okay to say no. Etiquette experts recommend that customers approach the touchscreen option the same way they would a tip jar. If they would leave change or a small cash tip in the jar, do so when prompted on the screen. Said Lizzie Post, a 10% tip for takeaway food is a really common amount. We also see change or a single dollar per order. If you aren't sure what to do, ask the worker if the store has a suggested amount. Andrew, you had some comments, and then I'll follow up.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed this too. I'm glad that my general approach for curbside service, which is tipping a dollar, is being mentioned here as a good guideline. I figure I'm going out to get it and then coming home, so they're not doing very much for me. But they are bringing it out to me, and that does deserve compensation. But it is harder to make a thoughtful decision when you're standing at a register and don't want to hold up the people behind you. Being unemployed, I can usually afford 10%, so that's what I default to in those situations. I do think, though, that it's time to abolish the sub-minimum wage for all kinds of workers. Many states have a sub-minimum for disabled workers as well, to say nothing of incarcerated workers, and bring all of those groups of workers' wages up to the federal minimum. It would take a lot of the pressure off of tipping and make it a genuine expression of thanks. It would also make wage theft much more difficult.
There are several things that crossed my mind when I was reading this article. The first thing that astonished me was that 60% of Uber customers don't tip.
Yeah.
I mean, that on the one hand, there is the norm that says, when someone is self-employed, you don't tip them. It's their business.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, taxi drivers are also, in a sense, self-employed. And
right.
Andrew apparently has never taken a taxi, so that's my age. So.
Well, I did once.
Okay,
and I did
once.
In the UK.
Once. But, I mean, I would never think of taking a taxi ride without tipping the driver. It just isn't done. So I don't know what this 60% of Uber customers are thinking. As for sub-minimum wage, I once worked a few months at a Carvel in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Now, Carvel, you know, being an ice cream stand slash store, you don't generally tip servers there.
Okay.
So it's not really a job for tipping. And yet my boss there thought it was fine to pay me the sub-minimum wage, which is the reason I only worked there for a couple of months.
Right.
I think for unemployed people to pay a 10% tip, I don't know. Maybe you're a richer unemployed person than I was when I was an unemployed person. I've spent about half my life poor or struggling. I've been through times in my life when I had to seriously debate whether I could afford a pizza. I had to, when I went out with friends, I had to debate how much I was going to leave as a tip to the nearest nickel. I mean, that's how tight things were for me. So on the one hand, I am sympathetic to sub-minimum wage workers, but I also resent being essentially dunned for a tip when I feel like they haven't done anything beyond their jobs. So that's partly where I am on the issue.
Yeah, I would say that it makes sense. I mean, if you don't have the money to tip, then you don't have the money to tip. One could argue that, you know, maybe you shouldn't be going out to eat anyway, but sometimes you don't have any other option.
Punish the poor.
Yeah, I mean, that's so much of our society. That's the, you know, ethos behind it. So, you know, I get that. Maybe 10% can be too much to tip, depending on what your situation is. For me, though, 10% is usually like a dollar or, you know, over a dollar. It's not that much. I don't know. Or at least it doesn't seem like that much to me. But then I grew up in a different era where money sort of had a different value. So
I grew up in an era where money was actually money.
Yeah. Yeah, you did.
I remember when credit cards were like a, I mean, that was something rich people had.
Yeah.
So, yeah, money used to be money, and now money is plastic, and now money is what's swiped on an iPhone.
Yeah.
Progress. Okay, coming up next, we're going to be talking about a mountain lion in L.A. and how that applies not only to Houston, but to the country generally. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media. Airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. Download with Google Podcasts, available from the Android and iPhone app stores. or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this and over 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media with over 100 show titles, most generated locally by volunteers. To do that means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for Think Wing Radio. I can't even say my own show name. Isn't that sad? You can show your support for Think Wing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hit the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, perhaps ours, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between. And you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift. And tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. Our next story is from CNN.com. P22, Los Angeles's famous mountain lion, has been euthanized after severe injuries from possible vehicle strike. The big cat made headlines last month after he attacked and killed a resident's leashed chihuahua. He was captured by authorities on Tuesday, who used GPS data from his tracking collar to locate and anesthetize him. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife made the decision to euthanize P22 after a comprehensive medical evaluation, according to a news release Saturday. The department said the compassionate euthanasia was unanimously recommended by the medical team at San Diego Zoo Safari Park and conducted under general anesthesia. He was in poor health overall and may also have had additional underlying conditions not yet fully characterized by diagnostics, said the department. Governor Gavin Newsom's father was a founder of the Mountain Lion Foundation and championed permanent protections for the species, according to the release. Quote, the iconic mountain lion's incredible journey helped inspire a new era of conserving and reconnecting nature, including through the world's largest wildlife overpass in Liberty Canyon, Newsom added. With innovative coalitions and strategies to restore vital habitat across the state, we'll continue working to protect California's precious natural heritage for generations to come. Earlier this year, construction on a wildlife crossing spanning 10 lanes along Highway 101 in California began, with hopes of creating a safer way for animals to roam in the region. In addition, Newsom promised $50 million for other similar projects throughout the state. We actually have one of those here in Houston in Memorial Park. There is a land bridge, and I think that it's opened or will open very shortly. So this is, you know, mostly a local L.A. story about a locally celebrated animal, but I decided to include it here and dedicate time to it because I feel it is representative of the problems faced by wildlife living near human development. Wild animals can't survive and thrive in small pockets of perhaps temporarily undeveloped land. Mm-hmm. Wildlife overpasses are a potential strategy that can help. I'm including reference links to a couple of stories about Houston and Texas where these wildlife overpasses are being developed. Andrew?
Yeah. As for the specific circumstances in the story, I can't find anything to object to here. They captured him to check on him. He wasn't in good shape, and it was just his time. It's sad, but I'm glad they consulted with wildlife care experts and that they anesthetized him first so he could pass in his sleep.
Our next story is from thehill.com. Majority of states call on Supreme Court to review constitutionality of CFPB funding. The CFPB is the Consumer Financial Protection Board. The story goes, more than three dozen attorneys general from red and blue states on Wednesday asked the Supreme Court to agree to decide the constitutionality of CFPB funding structure. The separate coalitions of Republican and Democratic state AGs urged the court to take up the case for sharply contrasting reasons. Led by West Virginia, a group of 16 red states want the justices to affirm a lower court decision that said the CFPB's funding structure usurps Congress's power over appropriations. The Republicans' attorneys general said in an amicus brief, not sure which, attaching the spending power directly to Congress, including power over agencies' budgets, makes the federal government more accountable to the states. A blue state brief signed by Washington, D.C., New York, and 20 other states backs the Biden administration's request that the Supreme Court reverse the lower court ruling. The CFPB, which enforces consumer financial laws, was formed by the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Law after the 2008 financial crisis and receives its funding, which totaled around $596 million last year, from the Federal Reserve. The Biden administration's petition for Supreme Court review said Congress's decision to fund the CFPB through annual transfers by the Federal Reserve was a valid use of its authority. I will point out that there is a lot more detail in this article if you want to refer to it. The link is on the site at thinkwingradio.com for today's show. To me, though, this is just another example of Republican officials working against the interests of their constituents for the commercial advantage of their donors. It's continually aggravating. Andrew?
Absolutely. With the way the court with the way the court is right now, though, I worry that they're more likely to agree with the Republicans and further harm what little protections consumers have in the U.S. financial sector.
Yeah, the Republicans have been fighting the CFPB since before it was formed, since it was formed, since after it was formed. Trump tried to kill it.
Because if there's one thing Republicans hate more than anything, it's not being able to exploit people to their fullest.
In short, Republicans just hate consumer protection.
Yeah.
Okay. Our next story is from azcentral.com, Arizona, that is. Abe Hamaday's challenge of Arizona Attorney General election to go to trial. A Mojave County judge has decided that Republican Attorney General candidate Abe Hamaday's election challenge can go to trial. Hamaday trails by 511 votes behind Democrat Chris Mays in one of Arizona's closest statewide elections. Mojave County Superior Court Judge Lee F. Jansen held that four counts of Hamaday's election challenge can proceed to trial, set for December 23rd. The decision noted how Hamaday's election lawsuit was distinct from some of the others that have been filed. Quote, "This case is different because the plaintiff is not alleging political motives or fraud or personal agendas being pushed. It is simply alleging misconduct by mistake or omission by election officials led to erroneous count of votes and which, if true, could have led to an uncertain result." Mays's attorney, Dan Barr, said he is confident his side will prevail. Barr said, "They're going to have to come forward with admissible facts and not, you know, information and belief. I mean, this is a court of law. It's not some Twitter thread or Fox News or something like that." It is noted in the story that in order for the judge to decide that this could go to trial, the Republican candidate's lawyer was not required to present any actual evidence. The evidence will be presented in court, so not even preliminary evidence. There is another story that's kind of a couplet with this. Maricopa judge allows narrow part of Kerry Lake's Arizona election lawsuit to head to trial. You may have heard of this one. A Maricopa County Superior Court judge ruled Monday that Arizona Republican Kerry Lake, who lost last month's gubernatorial race, will be allowed to head to trial on two narrow claims in an election lawsuit. Judge Peter Thompson ruled that the majority of the claims Lake made in her initial complaint, 8 out of 10, would be immediately dismissed. The motion to dismiss hearing in Maricopa County did not present evidence or witness testimony, but on two of the counts, the judge found Lake should be allowed to proceed to trial to attempt to prove intentional misconduct that resulted in her loss. Lake lost to Democrat Katie Hobbs, the current Secretary of State, as well as elect, by about 17,000 votes. The judge narrowed one allegation involving the printers on Election Day, allowing the Lake campaign to present evidence to back her claim that a Maricopa County employee had interfered with Election Day printers, resulting in her losing votes. The judge will also allow the Lake team to present evidence that Maricopa County violated its election manual regarding ballot chain of custody. The Lake campaign claims an unknown number of ballots were added, resulting in her loss. The judge called this claim a dispute of fact rather than law, so Lake should be allowed to present her evidence in court. Now, I looked this up. It wasn't in the story, but according to Arizona.vote, a total of 2,600,000 votes approximately were cast. Kerry Lake's lawsuit is probably a waste of the court's time. She is not going to find irregularities totaling over 17,000 votes to give her the election. On the other hand, Abe Hamaday's suit is qualitatively different, with a statewide difference of only 515 votes out of about 2,600,000. A recount is still unlikely to change the result on such a relatively large difference, so Hamaday is presenting a question of error by non-malicious intent. Nonetheless, having presented no evidence before being allowed a trial, this also seems a weak case to contest with. Andrew?
Well, I absolutely don't want either of these legal challenges to succeed. both because I don't want there to have been any election irregularities, and also because I don't want Republicans to win. But I do believe that all allegations of irregularity that can't be immediately disproven should be investigated, because elections need to be legitimate and democratic in order to be useful alternatives to violent
overthrow. And trustworthy is really important.
And trustworthy as well. My only caveat to that statement is that those investigations shouldn't hold up the transition of power. If it's discovered that the wrong person is seated, they can always give up, or be forced to give up, power to the duly elected. If a court of law is the place where those investigations occur, then so be it.
Our next story is from the WashingtonPost.com. Biden team planning a dramatically expanded digital strategy for 2024. One aim is to organize content sharing between supporters and their friends on digital platforms, including TikTok and WhatsApp, where political advertising is not allowed. And I thought this was an interesting story, I guess partly because of how I have experienced the change in how elections are campaigned over, you know, decades. It's just fascinating and annoying. Anyway, the story goes, President Biden's political advisors are preparing for a strategy for his likely 2024 reelection campaign that would dramatically expand efforts to organize content sharing between supporters and their friends on digital platforms, including TikTok and WhatsApp, where political advertising, as we said earlier, is not allowed, according to people involved. The plans, which build upon lessons from the 2020 campaign, are one part of an expansive research effort funded by the Democratic National Committee to prepare for Biden's expected campaign launch next year. Top advisors have been testing ways to reactivate volunteers and donors, and they completed a review this summer of the shifts in how voters consume political information over the past 2 years. The review found phone-based apps and streaming television have grabbed an increasing share of attention from voters, which offer fewer opportunities for direct advertising, according to multiple people involved in the effort, including some who spoke on condition of anonymity. Local television news continues to be popular, as does the use of search engines to ferret out political information. But much of the focus of party strategists has been on groups of voters who are increasingly spending time consuming information on private digital environments, mostly through their phones or on public platforms where paid political ads are not available, including chat threads and other smaller communities built around non-political interests such as fitness. Democratic strategists have concluded that in many cases, volunteers can have more impact by creating or distributing content to their digital communities than by spending their time on more traditional canvassing operations. As a result, the Biden team has been reviewing ongoing experiments run by the National Party and looking at Democratic Senate campaigns involving once obscure organizing strategies, which became more common in the 2022 midterms. The options include paying social media influencers to produce and share supportive content and encouraging volunteers or paid organizers to directly push messages to targeted voters in their phone contacts. There are also technologies that the party has been reviewing that make it easier for volunteers to share campaign content to their networks. Biden advisors emphasize that the new techniques will not replace traditional field programs. Investments in door-to-door canvassing, for example, are expected to increase over what past Democratic campaigns did before the coronavirus pandemic. Biden has not made a final decision on whether to run for re-election, though he has said it is his intention, with a formal decision expected in the first 3 months of 2023. Andrew?
So I've got a little bit of a story. Back in 2016, when I was still supporting Bernie Sanders, I phone banked for him, which was essentially cold calling voters on the rolls and reading from a script to them, answering basic questions, that sort of thing. I was actually in the UK at the time, so they didn't get a UK phone number on their caller ID because I called into a system, which
it
then
was spoofed.
It was spoofed. But, you know, I just thought that was fun. So the Bernie campaign actually extended that philosophy to Facebook in a
tactic. But I will point out, you're a U.S. citizen with every right to do this.
Right, exactly. If I was not a U.S. citizen, I
would have
done it.
That would be a whole different level.
Yeah. So the Bernie campaign extended that philosophy to Facebook in a tactic that they called face banking, where I copied and pasted a script to friends on Facebook Messenger and answered some of their basic questions. I actually went on to use the same face banking tactic in my own bid for student government president. Unfortunately, I didn't win. So I do have some personal experience with these kinds of once obscure tactics. What I don't like hearing is that candidates are starting to pay social media influencers to essentially make political advertising. You know, brands doing that is already pretty shady, but I think being paid to openly hold certain political opinions when a major part of your appeal as an influencer is your personality and thoughts, that's really crossing an ethical line to me. I also dislike the idea of organizers being encouraged to share political content to non-political groups. If there are organic discussions happening about politics, that's one thing. But to be told, hey, go post about the Democratic Party in your yoga group chat, it feels like the parties and candidates doing this are pushing their way into spaces where they don't fit. And I strongly doubt that voters will like that.
I don't disagree with your feelings about paying people or encouraging volunteers to do this. On the other hand, influencers on the internet, people want to be influencers because influencers then, when they have enough followers, do get paid to influence. So I think the slippery slope question becomes, well, how is this different? If influencers are always being paid, I mean, when Kim Kardashian goes to a nightclub, she's not going because she wants to go to the nightclub. She's going because she's getting paid to post about the fact that she went to the nightclub. Is this really substantively different, except for the fact that it brings politics and ideology and philosophy and political parties and all that messy stuff along with it? I mean, we know there are paid political operatives. To what extent is this different? If you get right down to it,
that's a very fair point. But my response is basically, I don't think it is substantially different, but I don't think that makes it better. I don't think that makes it more excusable. I think that makes it, you know, maybe more legal, perhaps. But I don't think that makes it right. And I don't think that makes it a thing that should be done or that we should be encouraging in our political sphere.
We're already getting extremely targeted political ads on our social media, because even anonymized data can eventually pinpoint you.
Yep. And that's perfectly legal.
Sometimes by name, but if not by name, then by all your interests and proclivities and locations, et cetera. And, you know, they can tag you where they want an ad to be when you are there. I mean, we live in a time that in some ways is just really sleazy, but should politics be excluded? I don't know. Should everything be excluded? I don't know. Where's the line?
Well, you know how I feel. The answer to those questions for me are yes and yet. So
I'm more of a gray line person, I guess. I just don't always know.
You're more of a pragmatist in this particular instance, I guess.
Yeah, I guess kind of, sort of, maybe. But I think that in either case, spreading misinformation and disinformation is never acceptable or excusable. That is one line I insist not be crossed, or at least every effort be made not to cross it. Okay, from Wired.com.
Well, before we move on to that story,
we might want to make that break.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is going to be about big tech laying off thousands of people and who wants them next. But first, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. Central. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. Download it with Google Podcasts, available from the Android and iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show and over 100 other KPFT programs, most of them locally produced. We do heavily excerpt every story on the show, which is why we include links to the full articles on show posts and more page at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738, option 1. That's 713-526-KPFT, option 1. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig, and I am on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio, and Andrew, of course, has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Okay, our next story from Wired.com, big tech laid off thousands. Here's who wants them next. Governments, nonprofits, and small startups hope to scoop up people let go by the likes of Meta and Amazon. It's their chance to lure top-tier talent. Remote work, competitive salaries, a streamlined hiring process. They're all perks being offered to prospective tech workers from an unlikely employer, the U.S. government. As companies like Meta, Amazon, and Google have cut jobs or slowed hiring, government, nonprofit, and smaller companies are now seizing the moment and looking to catch the attention of out-of-work technologists. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is seeking tech workers to fill 1,000 jobs. They'll work on solving problems like modernizing benefits software and revamping medical appointment scheduling. Big tech's losses could be a boon to these employers. Nearly 1,000 tech companies around the world have laid off more than 150,000 tech workers this year. But tech jobs make up just a small slice of the U.S. economy, and experts say recent layoffs are a high-profile outlier, occluding a strong job market still hungry for workers. So tech workers are turning elsewhere for opportunities, and they're increasingly looking for jobs in the nonprofit, smaller startups, and government. Some governments have long struggled to secure top talent and younger workers. The divides in the private and public sector extend beyond the U.S. In China, some young workers are ready to leave behind a volatile tech industry for greater security. Finland's government was so eager for tech workers to join the country's industry that in 2021, it gave workers a 90-day visa to try out life in Helsinki. Tech Jobs for Good, a job board that focuses on mission-driven employers, saw a 40% increase in job seeker profiles in males, says its founder Noah Hart. In October, as other tech companies began cutting employees, profile signups jumped another 30%, Hart says. He goes on, there's been a longer trend of more and more job seekers looking for impactful roles. A lot of organizations are still hiring and are getting a lot more applications. Nonprofits and governments are trying to become more competitive. The average job posted on Tech Jobs for Good pays between $118,000 and $134,000, Hart says. By comparison, software engineers at Google make between $98,000 and $330,000. Data scientists earn $113,000 to $200,000. The VA is working to close the existing pay gap between its roles in the private sector by 60%. Smaller startups or industries like retail and healthcare are also benefiting from the group of technologists let loose. The most proactive employers could walk away winners. Joshua Browder, CEO of an AI robot lawyer company, tweeted in November that he wanted to hire people affected by layoffs and would offer jobs to immigrants and sponsor their visas to help people who lost their jobs stay in the U.S. He goes on, I was actually quite surprised that the companies were laying them off because they are incredibly talented people. He says, I think these companies are making a mistake by being too aggressive with their layoffs. 6 months ago, Browder says, he likely would have had to pay tens of thousands of dollars to a recruiter to get such talent. Now, they're landing in his inbox for free. Andrew?
Well, it doesn't surprise me that governments are interested in hiring tech workers. I know, for example, that the IRS is still using a system from the 1960s called the Individual Master File to handle tax return processing, and modernization of that system has been tried and failed, or only partially successful, many times. In addition to needing people who could modernize it, for good this time, they need people who know COBOL to keep it running in the meantime. What I'm hoping,
COBOL.
Though,
when I was in college.
Yep. What I'm hoping, though, is that this increased demand could give these tech workers more leverage in attempts at unionizing. There may be plenty of applicants, but they have high expectations from previous jobs, and employers may not want to go through the screening and negotiating processes again if workers threaten to strike or quit.
That's kind of an interesting take. I'm kind of thinking in terms of all the stories I've read over decades about how backwards government computer systems, hardware, and software are. Mm. I mean, we're talking CRT monitors instead of flat screens, and
yep,
floppy disks instead of thumb drives, and IBM PCs instead of like really fast computers. I mean, do you know that our nuclear systems, our nuclear defense systems, still use, they're not even the 5 1/4 inch disks. They're like
the huge
really
ones.
Big disks.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ones that are like 12 inches wide.
The
5 1/4s are considered the mini disks.
Yeah, they use the ones that are actually floppy.
yeah, the ones that are so big they do flop. I mean, as opposed to the 5 1/4 ones, which can flop.
Yeah.
I think that this is a great opportunity for governments to really step up their game, increase their efficiency, save money, and put hopefully that money into social goods. Okay, probably our last story from thehill.com, Biden administration proposing phase out of compact fluorescent light bulbs. This actually resonates with me. A proposed Department of Energy rule would phase out the use of compact fluorescent light bulbs, or CFLs, as part of the Biden administration's efforts to remove less energy efficient bulbs from the market. Current standards require light bulbs to be at least 45 lumens, the unit used to measure brightness per watt. So 45 lumens per watt. Under the proposed update, first reported by CNN, the standard would be more than doubled to more than 120 lumens per watt. Commonplace 60-watt equivalent light bulbs would only require a maximum of 6.5 watts, according to an analysis by Appliance Standards Awareness Project. Standards aimed at phasing out incandescent bulbs in general were first passed by Congress during the Bush administration and put into practice during the Obama administration. However, in 2019, the Trump regime, not their word, unwound the rule because, you know, water efficiency and electric efficiency and burn that oil and waste that water. But anyway, the Biden administration resumed implementation of the rule, finalizing it in April. There are several points I like in this story. First, they define brightness by lumens per watt. I discussed this on a show quite a while back. The so-called wattage equivalencies claimed on packaging vary wildly in terms of actual lumens to the point of being deceptive. Second,
this, want to quickly interject. That reminds me of the conversations nerds have about Star Trek's use of parsecs being a measurement of distance, not of time.
Star Wars.
Sorry.
Yes. What is it? The Kessel Run?
The Kessel Run.
Yeah. Parsecs, that goes to show which side of the nerd divide I'm on.
Yeah. Anyway, please continue.
Yeah, anyway. Second, while the difference in energy efficiency between CFLs and LEDs is not drastic, it is significant in terms of percentages and would make a huge cumulative difference in the energy dedicated to national lighting. Third, this story doesn't mention it, but CFLs, compact fluorescent lights, are a health and environmental hazard because they contain mercury. Mm-hmm. LEDs do not. This is why CFLs are dangerous if broken and need to be recycled carefully rather than thrown away. The same, by the way, is true of traditional tube fluorescents, but most stores won't take them anymore to recycle due to their size. If you cannot find a place to recycle fluorescent tubes, the best way, at least I know, to dispose of them is to put them in a big trash bag, close the bag tightly, and break the tubes in the bag to prevent mercury from escaping and being inhaled.
Mm. Should be mentioned, if you do that, we accept no responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, this is as far as I know. Mm. This is not an expert's perspective. But, you know, like looking at CFLs versus LEDs now, if you look at comparable lumens, an LED often saves maybe a watt or two per bulb. But in percentage terms, that can be 15, 18% or more.
Yeah.
You know, you multiply that by millions of light bulbs, and that starts to make a dent. So in an era when, you know, we're trying to get to at least net zero, some people don't like that term, but it's better than nothing. In that kind of an era where we're trying to maximize every erg of electricity we generate and trying to get the most out of it with the least waste heat, because I'll tell you this. This is another interesting point. Mm-hmm. Incandescent bulbs, aside from being dramatically less efficient than either CFLs or LEDs, also cost you more to air condition.
Yes.
Because they throw off a lot of heat. Mm. And cumulatively, they actually cause your air conditioner to work harder. Now, this may be a plus, you know, when ERCOT, again, fails to do its job. But you know, warm your hand on that light bulb, kind of like the future Terminator universe. Again, my side of the nerd divide. I mean, I think that this is an important advocation.
Not just in terms of consumer safety, but also in terms of environmental concerns.
Yeah. Now, one thing I will also note is there was a time when CFLs were being let me rephrase that. When incandescent bulbs were being legislatively phased out in preference to CFLs, one of the arguments against that was that the incandescent bulbs were still heavily being made in the United States, whereas the CFLs were mostly being made in Asia.
Ah.
Now, LEDs use a chip. They're silicon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there's no mercury. There's no filament. And, you know, you could make an argument that if we're going to make more chips in the United States, maybe we could make more LED light bulbs. But currently, LEDs are still heavily made in Asia. So we are literally still dependent on the Middle East for the energy to keep the lights on, and Asia for the lights that the Middle East is keeping on.
Mm. Well, I think we might possibly have time to talk about mystery recordings.
Well, maybe we do have time for one more. This is from April 5th. I've actually been saving it. I just thought it was interesting. Mystery recordings will now be heard for the first time in about 100 years from NPR. Before audio playlists, before cassette tapes, and even before records, there were wax cylinders, the earliest mass-produced way people could listen both to commercial music and record themselves. In the 1890s, they were a revolution. People slid blank cylinders onto their Edison phonographs or shaved down the wax on commercial cylinders and recorded their families, their environments, themselves. They haven't been heard because the wax is so fragile. The earliest putty-colored cylinders deteriorate after only a few dozen listens if played on the Edison machines. They crack if you hold them too long in your hand. And because the wax tubes themselves were unlabeled, many of them remain mysteries. They could be people's birthday parties, one person said. Recordings could tell us more about the social history of the time. Or they could be the Star-Spangled Banner or something incredibly common. She really hopes for people's birthday parties. So enter the endpoint cylinder and Dictabilt machine, invented by Californian Nicholas Berg, which recently was acquired by the library. And thanks to the combination of its laser and needle, it can digitize even broken or cracked wax cylinders. And there are a lot of those. But Berg said the design of the cylinder, which makes it fragile, is also its strength. One of those important collections owned by the library is the Mapleson Cylinders, a collection recorded by Lionel Mapleson, the Metropolitan Opera's librarian at the turn of the last century. Mapleson recorded rehearsals and performances. It's the only way listeners can hear pre-World War I opera singers with a full orchestra. Bob Kosofsky, a librarian in the Music and Recorded Sound Division, said the Mapleson cylinders, quote, represent the first extensive live recordings in recorded history. He said that some of the stars sing in ways no contemporary opera singer would sing, and that gives us a sort of keyhole into what things were like then. Not necessarily to do it that way today, but just to know what options are available and how singers and performers and audiences conceived of these things, which is so different from our own conception. It's a way of opening our minds to hear what other possibilities exist. It will take the library a couple of years to digitize all its cylinders. I just thought this was an amazing story. It's like finding a movie of Abraham Lincoln. Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder how far they are through digitizing their collection and if they made any major discoveries. Even if they don't do that, I think that there's still value in recording the minutia of the past and preserving it because it gives us a more complete picture. Not to mention that this digitization effort will undoubtedly help pave the way for future wax cylinder cataloging.
Okay, from this side of the nerd divide, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on Houston's Community Media, 90.1 KPFT FM HD2. My co-host, indispensable editor, and person who occasionally laughs at my jokes is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Look forward to speaking to you again next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning?
Mama, what does the chicken say?
Chicken. Oh, okay.
And a wolf?
Oh, a wolf. Ooh!
What about the tiny dog? Cat.
Aww.
Owl.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Dolphin? What does the turkey say? Whale.
Yeah, whale sound.
Do the giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Okay. Giraffe. Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
It's time to holler down the pipe chase and rattle them bars.
The Prison Show airs Fridays 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM KPFT. For over 40 years, each two-hour program uses an hour to discuss issues and organizations of importance to prisoners and their families to help educate and inform our listeners. The second hour broadcasts shout-outs, live calls from inmates' family and friends so inmates can hear their loved ones speaking on the air. For over 40 years, the show has connected Texas prison inmates with their friends and loved ones over the airwaves. You can't find an older Texas show, and it's right here on KPFT every Friday, 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM KPFT or online at kpft.org, Houston's community station.